Matthew chapter 1 has a key passage we'll probably be reviewing for the next couple of weeks. It is the genealogy of the Lord Jesus. Let me read that for you. Matthew chapter 1, starting in verse 1, a number of names here, and just to give you a reason for reading through some of the difficult portions of the Bible where a whole bunch of hard-to-say names are listed. How in the world does that help me live for the Lord today? Well, not all of the Bible is meant to be a manual for how to live. Some of it is information that's important to God that he wants us to value as well. And some of those names are worth learning. In fact, I've known several different people who have gone through and made the family tree of the Bible just with the names that we have there, with the understanding that sometimes they would skip generations to emphasize the big rocks in the family. But let me read for you these generations in Matthew chapter 1 to start our time this morning in the Word. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Now this is significant for this morning. Judah begot Perez, in verse 3, and Zerah by Tamar. Perez begot Hezron, and Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nashon, and Nashon begot Salmon. I don't know how to say that name right. Salmon? Salmon? It's a name, not a fish. Verse 5. Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, as we read in Ruth this morning. That was that family unity. Obed begot Jesse. Jesse begot David the king. David the king begot Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon begot Rehoboam. Rehoboam begot Abijah, and Abijah begot Asa. Asa begot Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat begot Joram, and Joram begot Uzziah. Uzziah begot Jotham. Jotham begot Ahaz, and Ahaz begot Hezekiah. Hezekiah begot Manasseh. Manasseh begot Ammon. Ammon begot Josiah. Josiah begot Jeconiah and his brothers about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begot Shealtiel, and Shealtiel begot Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel begot Abiad, Abiad begot Eliakim, and Eliakim begot Azor. Azor begot Zadok, Zadok begot Achim, and Achim begot Eliad. Eliad begot Eleazar, Eleazar begot Mathan, and Mathan begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. That means the anointed one. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David until the captivity in Babylon are 14 generations. And from the captivity in Babylon until the Christ are 14 generations. I hope you were encouraged by that reading. Those names, each one carries significance. This is one of the genealogies that emphasizes the big rocks. There were grandchildren and other things and other branches of the tree that branched off in other directions, but these all led to the promised seed. Remember we talked about that a few weeks ago? The promised seed. It was promised even in Genesis, and that promised seed was protected. What are we when we're not with God, when we're not aligned with him, when we're not trying to be close to him, when we're not listening to him to step in line with him, what do we become? Well, if you look around, you can see the problems that are happening when a whole slew of people decide that they themselves can rule themselves. They can decide for them what's good and evil. They can decide what's appropriate for them and what's not appropriate. Thank you very much. They might have needed their parents when they were young, but they grow into independence far sooner than they actually do in their minds. Self-ruling. We consider that we are right. Not always, but most of the time. We consider that we have rights. And by the way, people better acknowledge and respect my rights. This is what happens when we are not with God. We become gods unto ourselves. Even in our religion, we decide who is God for me because he's more convenient than some other God who has a mind of his own. Usually, our religion, when we're not aligned with God, has more to do with me and the blessings I can glean from that relationship than serving him and being a blessing to him. Very inward focusing. We seek to please ourselves and our own pleasure. We seek to promote ourselves and the things that we think are important. And anyone who doesn't work with us or submit to us, we consider a problem. We might avoid them. We might not hang around them. We just can't do it. We just can't stand those kind of people. Or we might manipulate them to get them to give us what we want despite their will. In fact, when you follow this all the way to its, not to its end, because that usually results in some form of death, but if you follow along the process, late stage self-rule usually results in us seeing people either as someone to help me get what I want or somebody in the way of what I want, an obstacle or a path, and not another person who has the same mind. Self-rule is dangerous. God created us to be dependent upon him, to let him rule. Yes, to keep our minds. Yes, to keep our work in our hands and to be able to choose. But when you're aligned with God, a lot of the problems that we're facing in the world today just dry up. It can take time, but eventually those problems go away. Even when we add religion to self-rule and the peer pressure and the public perspective that can cause us to mute some of our behaviors for the sake of the respect we crave, really it's far better to give in to God and to give ourselves over. Without God, we usually end up making a mess. Like Judah and Tamar. So if you turn with me back to Genesis chapter 38, it's one of the most difficult chapters in the Bible. It's good that the kids have left the room, not because of, you know, just to avoid difficult questions until the timing is right as you're raising them and helping them. Judah and Tamar made a mess of things. I find that when I talk to police officers that are concerned with really helping people, we both have similar perspectives, pastors and police officers who are doing real ministry and real helping people in the community. There are those policemen who do that, you know. Very good people, at least when it comes to helping people and their desire. In these particular cases, when you're doing real ministry, oftentimes you have to engage with people when they've made a mess of things. And sometimes there's a risk of getting sucked into the mess as well as you're trying to help them. It can be very chaotic, very messy, and sometimes even dangerous. In fact, some of the violence we've heard about that happened in churches didn't just happen out of the blue. Nowadays, sometimes that happens. Some guy gets twisted in his views about Christianity or Muslims or whatever and comes in and does violence. But sometimes it happens because a church actually was caring for people and their self-rule was especially strong one day in the mess that they had made, and they react with violence. Life can be incredibly messy. It's not like what they tell you in Bible college. And nowadays, maybe they've changed. Sometimes in seminary, it gets a little sterile. You're studying the Bible and you're studying human problems without necessarily the human personalities involved as well. And it can be very, very messy and very chaotic. And sometimes things, you start wondering, is everybody broken this? Does that level of darkness, is that something all of us have touched or tasted? There's a reason why there's this classic, I forget the word, not idiosyncrasy, ID, never mind. You know, it's how cops sometimes can get jaded, theoretically. Everybody hears about the jaded cop. Why does that happen? Well, it's because they expected the world to be like it looks on the surface and underneath. I've met jaded soldiers that were absolutely shocked and horrified that soldiers aren't all the honorable, clean-cut, sparkly uniform with, you know, all the right snappy and everything. Sometimes it's messy because we're talking about human beings. Church, full of human beings, hopefully with similar values and pursuits, but all in different places along in that pursuit, right? The messy way that life can become, especially when you're trying to help people who haven't been working with God, it can be very real. And in this particular chapter, I like J. Vernon McGee. He said, this is one of the worst chapters in the Bible. And you'll see why as we go through it. First of all, let's take a look at Judah. I'm not going to read through the chapter with you bit by bit. For sake of time, we're going to jump through. Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, or Israel, Judah was the same one who suggested that they not kill Joseph, instead they sell him into slavery. Wasn't that good? Let's not kill him. Let's sell him in slavery. Well, no, that's not really good, selling your family into slavery. But it's better than murder, right? At least the way we measure things. This was Judah. It seems as though, however, this man, the fourth son of Jacob's first wife, Leah, made a mess of things. Look with me, if you would, at chapter 38, verses 1 and 2. It says, it came to pass that at that time that Judah departed from his brothers. Possibly he was frustrated and jaded by his brothers, perhaps horrified by their suggestion of murder of one of their own. But for whatever reason, he departed from his brothers, it says in verse 1, and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. The Adullamites were a tribe of the Canaanites who lived a little further south by the northern part of the Dead Sea, between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean. In fact, there's a cave where David had his headquarters for a little while, called the Cave of Adullah, or something like that. It's another place in the scriptures. In verse 2, it says, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her, so she conceived and bore a son, and we'll get into their sons in a moment. Judah did six bad choices that made kind of a mess of his life. And it's messy, so bear with me, please, as we go through this, because it gets very, very human in this chapter. First, the first thing he did of the six that he made when he made a mess of his life is he left his family. As messy as his family was, as gritty and as, earthy as they were, they were still the promised children, promised to Abraham, promised to Isaac, promised to Jacob. They were the sons of Israel, and there was safety in staying in the family. So the first thing he did is he abandoned his family. As you saw in verse 1, he departed from his brothers. The second thing he did is he started hanging around with worldly people. I mentioned to you about Adullam. There's still an ancient ruin there. That Adullam was once numbered among the 36 cities of the Canaanite lands. And Joshua, it says in Joshua chapter 12, it was one of the 36 cities who Joshua and the children of Israel smote, as it says in the older translations. They defeated that land and the region called Adullam. first thing he did, he left his family, then he started hanging around with worldly people. You know why it's dangerous to hang around with worldly? I don't mean being near them. We have to be in the world, right? We have to function. We have to go to Walmart for things, if you shop at Walmart. We have to be in the world and around worldly people. But that's different than hanging around with them, becoming close friends with them, trusting them to be different than what worldly people are. There's a danger in that, because the friends that you choose, well, what did we teach our kids? What do the friends you choose do to you? You become like them. Now, there's ways to be protecting in that, but there's a reason why God intended for a believer's community to be the church family, in the world but not of it. And there's safety in being part of the family of God, right? In this particular case, a little different than the church, but Judah not only left his family, but he started hanging around with worldly people who thought differently and had different gods and behaved differently. As you will see, they didn't behave differently than what we're seeing in today's world, but they behaved differently than what God calls his children to behave like. Thirdly, he took a worldly wife. In verses 1 and 2, you can see in verse 2 that Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite. That's where I said, uh-oh, whose name was Shua. The reason I said, uh-oh, is because Judah had undoubtedly heard the family history. And remember who Abraham wanted for his son to marry? Not a Canaanite, but somebody from back where they came from. Remember that? Of the Chaldeans. In fact, it was such a serious thing, he made his servant make a vow about finding someone not a Canaanite. Judah was completely throwing away family tradition and history that was aligned with God, at least as they understood it at the time. Remember when Esau took wives of the Canaanites? In Genesis 26, it says, Esau was 40 years old. He took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beri, the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. The Hittites were Canaanites, one of the several civilizations there that were meant to be taken over. And Genesis chapter 26 says, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. You remember that? Why would they be a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah? Well, they had different values. They had a different way of looking at the world. They had different morals than what God called his children to live like. I wonder if Judah thought this was going to go well, just marrying somebody out of the blue, just being a normal, everyday guy instead of one of the children of Israel. The seven nations in Canaan that God was planning to destroy, that Acts 13 says that God destroyed, were from the north to the south, the Hivites that were up in the north of the Sea of Galilee, the Girgashites that lived in the Galilee region, the Canaanites that were in the western plains, the Amorites that were in the eastern mountains, the Jebusites around and including Jerusalem, the Perizzites in the southwest near Gaza, that's been in the news lately, and the Hittites that lived near the Dead Sea. In Deuteronomy 7, it says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you shall go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, dot, dot, dot. And he continues with the promise there. Guess who Judah married? One of them. That was a third thing that he did that made his life messy. He also made promises he wasn't going to keep. Look with me at verses 6 through 11. And let's look at the fact that Judah had stopped being a man of his word. It says, then Judah took a wife for his firstborn. Was his firstborn son. And her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. By the way, the Lord is only mentioned a few times in this chapter, and this is one of them. There's another one coming up. Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. There it is, the kinsman redeemer thing. If your brother dies, you take his wife under your wing, you marry her, and you bear children. Those children, you will raise them, but they will be your dead brother's children. They will carry his name, and that way the family tree of the people of Israel will continue. This was what God instructed them to do. In this particular case, it was more of a cultural thing in the family, but later it would become law. But it was part of the kinsman redeemer's responsibility to take your brother's family and make it your own if he dies, especially early on. So, verse 8, Judah said to Onan, go into your wife's brother, marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother. Have children with her. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. So he was being selfish. There's that self-rule. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to her brother, to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore he killed him also. So there's two sons who displeased the Lord in their behavior and their lifestyle, and God took them out of the picture. You know what God was doing? I mean, doesn't that seem a bit extreme to reach into Judah's life? Was he killing kids from other people's family in the family of Jacob? Well, thanks to the fact that we have all of the rest of the Bible and a number of other passages to look at, we know, even from the passage we saw from Matthew with the genealogy of Christ, that God was protecting the line of the promised seed. God was involved. We'll look at that a little more closely, Lord willing, as we continue. Well, the name Ur means awake, and he died for being evil. The name Onan means strong, and he died for not honoring God's way of taking care of the family line. Shelah was Judah and Shua's third son. His name, a request, and he was best. Let's continue reading there in chapter 38, verse 10. The thing which Onan did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown, for he said, lest he also die like his brothers. You could almost hear him saying, I don't know what's up with this girl, but all my sons keep dying when they marry her. That's not what was happening. So he said, wait till Shelah, the youngest son, is grown, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. That was the promise that Judah made to Tamar. But if you jump down to verse 26 with me, it says, Judah acknowledged, we'll get to the signet and the cord and the staff, and said, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her to Shelah my son, and he never knew her again. So as we get to that part of the story later, remember there's a very difficult chapter, a hard chapter in the Bible, because it shows the reality of what it is to be human and ruling yourself rather than submitting to God's way. But when Judah made promises to Tamar, wait till my youngest son is grown and you can marry him, he wasn't going to do it. He made promises that he wasn't planning to keep. And that was the fourth thing in the six that he did that made a mess of his life. In verse 13 through 16, remember, Tamar was feeling cheated. She had recognized that Shelah was old enough to marry, and it wasn't happening. She was still in her widow's clothes, living in her father's house, and being ignored by Judah. Verse 13 says, it was told Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. Then Judah saw her. He thought she was a harlot, because she had covered her face. Then he turned to her by the way and said, please let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? This was a contractual agreement they were making verbally, and she was playing the role of a prostitute, and he was going to use a prostitute. This is another thing that Judah did that made his life messy. He was using a prostitute. It doesn't sound like he was inexperienced with the process. If he's going to do it this time, we don't have record of him practicing that on a regular basis, but it's not unreasonable to assume that this wasn't the first time that he did this. Hopefully it was the last. But Judah was making a mess of his life. Verses 24 to 26, we see that he also practiced hypocrisy, self-righteousness, and condemning others. Look with me, if you would, at verses 24 to verse 26. It says, and it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. Remember, she disguised herself as a harlot, and she slept with Judah, and they conceived. But then she went back to her father's house, took off the veil, put on her widow's garments again, and pretty soon she began to show that she was pregnant. Verse 24, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, Judah was called. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. What? Why would he do that? Well, he's being offended that his daughter-in-law did something that he had done. Judah was self-righteous and a hypocrite, and his life was a mess. When she was brought out, she said to her father-in-law, by the way, this is another evidence that truth will always bubble to the surface. In one way or another, the truth of things bubbles to the surface. Be sure your sin will find you out, it says in the Bible. When she was brought out, it says in verse 25, she said to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine which these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son, and he never knew her again. In the end, of course, she had twins, and there's more to it in the chapter in the last few verses there. But do you see what happened here, how Judah made a mess of his life? Six different things, choices that he could have made differently that complicated his life and brought all kinds of messiness in. He married that Canaanite woman and had three sons, not a one of which is named in Jesus' genealogy. And he was cheating Tamar, and then he unknowingly cheated with Tamar. And by the way, one of their sons is named in Jesus' genealogy. Now, Tamar also made a mess of her life, which we would expect, that she came from a worldly background. Her name means palm tree. That's why in the bulletin, the title of the sermon is Palm Tree. Angie loves palm trees. And there is a palm tree indeed in the line of Jesus' genealogy. Her name is Tamar. She made a mess of her life. Each of her husbands died due to evil. Now, we could argue that that's not necessarily something she could have helped, but we also don't have any evidence that she was resisting, that she was suggesting that they not, that she was an encouragement to righteousness to her husband, which is neither here nor there. Maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. But when Shelah, Judah's youngest son, matured, and Judah didn't fulfill his promise to her, verses 12 through 15, we've already seen she played the harlot with the goal of sleeping with her father-in-law. That's not how God planned the family to work. Verses 16 to 18, she lied, she manipulated, and she fornicated with Judah. We've set Judah aside. We've already acknowledged he stepped sideways from God's way. But she also was stepping sideways from God's way, not honoring God's plan for the family, not honoring God's plan for marital intimacy, to be within the bounds of marriage. This was a mess. Judah ultimately had children by his own daughter-in-law. That's messy. Complicated. It's just a mess. These people needed more of God. They needed more of God's way. God can take a mess. This is the lesson for this morning. God can take any mess, any way that people in the world have destroyed their lives and destroyed their bodies. God can salvage beauty even out of that if they will turn to Christ. God is the master potter. He can take broken and messed up clay and make something useful and beautiful out of it. This is who God is. And this is what God did in this case. We're still kind of having to step through this muddy, sticky situation with Judah and Tamar. But let me finish about Tamar quickly. Verses 24 to 26, she turned family issues into, excuse me while I say this, she made it a game. And the only reason why I call it a game, really it was a manipulation. but she won. She got what she wanted. She won. How do you win if it's not a game? If it's not a manipulation? Family's not supposed to be a game. It's not always supposed to be about, I want this, and everybody else is out to get it first, and so I gotta fight my way and claw my way. Tamar wanted children. I mean, she was being mistreated, right? She was being mistreated. She wasn't being treated fairly. But she wanted children. She was in a situation where she was being cared for and provided for in her father's house. And she was being lied against because Judah had lied to her. But what she wanted was being withheld. And remember what I said about what it's like working without God? Somebody's either a pathway to help you get what you want or an obstacle in your way holding you back from what you want. Without God, that's how you view people. And this is what Tamar did. She manipulated the situation. She played fast and loose with sex, and she got what she wanted. Both of these two people are guilty of self-rule. Right? Both of these two people. In case we need to talk about Tamar's innocence in all of this, let's remember that one person's sin does not justify another person's sin. Right? One person's sin never justifies another person's sin. It doesn't matter how horrible the abuse was against them or if it even leads to their death. When we stand before God, we answer for our own sins. And the justifications we have do not make them less of a sin. Lying to save lives is still lying. And God is truth. You can't not offend truth when you lie. It helps to remember that God is in control of who dies and how they die, and who lives and how they live. Well, not how they live, but you know, how their life processes, especially in light of their choices. God is the one in control of life and death. What a mess these two people made, Judah and Tamar. But, like I said, if it weren't for God and his amazing grace, this would be the end of today's lesson. Let me review a second point quickly. Where was God in all of this? He's not named anywhere in the chapter except when he took the lives of Ur and Onan. Some terrible sins happened there. And some terrible sins happened as it continued with Tamar and Judah. But verses 27 to 30, it says, "Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that, behold, twins were in Tamar's womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand. His wife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, 'This one came out first.' Then it happened as he drew back his hand that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, 'How did you break through this breach? This breaking through be upon you.' Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah." You remember when we read Jesus' genealogy? Remember the name Perez there? This was him. Tamar, Judah, and Perez were in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. There are significant implications to that. Lastly, the final point, out of chaos, God protects the promised seed. Like Joseph said when he confronted his brothers, he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day." Psalm 147:3 says, "He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds." 2 Corinthians 5:17 says, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." So someone who is a thief stops being a thief when they come to Christ, when they stop stealing because of him. someone who is an alcoholic as he gradually learns to stop being a slave to that because now he's enslaved himself to Christ. He stops being an alcoholic. Different than the world teaches. You can stop being addicted. The more you give yourself over to him. We read Ruth chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, where the leaders, the elders in the town said to Boaz, who was taking Ruth in that same kinsman redeemer way, "May your family be like Tamar was to Judah, who gave them Perez and his brother." And of course, we saw in Matthew chapter 1 that they are in Jesus' family line. There are a number of sinners in Jesus' family tree. Did you know that? A number of dirty, rotten liars, a number of cheats and adulterers. What does that mean? Well, let me read for you this last thing as I close, and this is the last of my notes. God can bring good out of our failure, Chuck Swindoll wrote in his book called The Quest for Character, and even out of our sins. J. Stuart Holden tells of an old Scottish mansion close to where he had his little summer home. The walls of one room in that mansion were filled with sketches. On the walls, sketches by distinguished artists. The practice began after a pitcher of soda water accidentally splashed on a freshly decorated wall and left an ugly stain. At the time, a noted artist named Lord Landseer was a guest in the house. One day, when the family went out of the house and were doing things outside, he stayed behind. With a few masterful strokes of a piece of charcoal, that ugly spot on the wall became the outline of a beautiful waterfall bordered by trees and wildlife. Lord Landseer had turned that disfigured wall into one of his most successful depictions of Highland life, according to Chuck Swindoll. And this is what God does. He takes something that's broken, that's messed up, and that's ugly. And when that heart turns to God, he can take that messy, messy life, complicated with twists and turns, and he can make something beautiful out of it. As we continue to look at the Lord Jesus, and we continue to see the way he works, and we look at even his genealogy, all of it is a testimony to what he can do. And if you've put your faith in him, you know that he has done this with us as well. Let's have the music people come up and close this morning's service.